Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we did verse 13, go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. And then verse 14, whereas ye know not what shall be upon the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on in James here, chapter 4. So the next verse is verse 15. I'll go ahead and read that. For ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. Now, having disproved their confidence, he proceeds to rectify it by pressing them to a holy and reverent remembrance of God's providence and their own frailty. Now he goes through the words of the verse. For ye ought to say, if the Lord will. Here a doubt arises. Must we always of necessity use this form of speech or such an express exception and reservation of providence? I answer, number one, it is good to accustom the tongue to holy forms of speech. It is a great help. The heart is best when there are such explicit and express exceptions of providence. If the Lord please, or if the Lord will, if it please the Lord that I live, a pure lip becomes a Christian, that they may be distinguished by their holy forms, as others are by their oaths, rotten speech, and unholy solicitations. Besides, it is useful to stir up reverence in ourselves and for others' instruction. Such forms are confessions of divine providence and the uncertainty of human life. Number two, the children of God use them frequently. 1 Corinthians 4:19, but I will come unto you shortly if the Lord will. So 1 Corinthians 16:7, I must tarry a while with you if the Lord permit. So Romans 1:10, making request, if by any means I might have a prosperous journey to come unto you. So Philippians 2:19, I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly. The children of God know that all their goings are ordered by the Lord. Therefore, they often use these reservations of his will and power. See also Genesis 28:20 and Hebrews 6, verse 3. Number three, the very heathens, by the light of nature, were wont or often to use these forms with some religion and would seldom speak of any purpose of theirs without this holy parenthesis. Plato brings in Alcibiades asking Socrates how he should speak, and he answers, before every work you must say, if God will. The Greek a word by the leave or blessing of God was commonly used in the beginning of every undertaking. What was the practice of the Oriental nations with the story of Ben-Sira, you may see in Gregory's observations on some passages of Scripture, and for the story of the great Turks murdering one of the Bassus for mentioning a confident purpose without any reservation of God's pleasure, you may see it in Lorinus and Salmeron on this place. Number four, when we use these forms, the heart must go along with the tongue. Common speeches, wherein God's name is used, if the heart be not reverent, are but profanations. It is Austin's counsel or Augustine's counsel, do you learn to have it in your hearts what every one has in his tongue? The speeches are common, but the signification is useful. Number five, it is not always necessary to express these forms, though there must be always either implicitly or expressly a submission to the will of God, yet we cannot make it a sin to omit such phrases. The holy men of God have often purposed things to come, and yet not formally expressed such conditions, as in the third epistle of John, verse 10, wherefore when I come, I will remember his deeds. And Romans 15:24, whensoever I take my journey to Spain, I will come to you, etc., and in other places. Now, his observation, all our undertakings must be referred to the will of God, not only sacred, but civil actions. Our journeys must not be undertaken without asking his leave. As Jacob, Genesis 28:20 and 24, verse 12, O Lord God of Abraham, thy servant, send me good speed this day. No wonder, if this be neglected, that you meet with so many cross accidents. They do not come from your hard luck, but your profane neglect. But what is it to submit all our actions to the will of God? I answer, number one, to measure all our actions by his revealed will, that is the rule of duty, so his word, we can look for no blessing but upon those ways that suit with it. There must be a submission to his secret will, but first a conformity to his revealed will. Lust, and typically lust is just generally the corrupt desires of the heart, lust has its own wills, Ephesians 2 verse 2, but we are to serve the will of God till we fall asleep, Acts 13, 36. Number two, we must the more comfortably undertake any action when we see God in it. Acts 16, 10, he gathered that God had called him to Macedonia. So when we see God in the sweet means and course of his providence, or by inward instinct guiding and leading us, we may with more encouragement walk in the way that he has opened to us. Number three, when in our desires and requests we do not bind the counsels of God, Matthew 26, 39, not my will but thine be done. In temporal things we must submit to God's will, both for the mercy, the means, and the time of attainment. Creatures that cannot ascribe to themselves must not prescribe to God and give laws to providence, but must be content to want or have as the Lord pleases, to lack or have as the Lord pleases. If anything succeed not well, the Lord would not. That is enough to silence all discontents. Number four, we must constantly ask his leave in prayer, as before was urged. Number five, we must still reserve the power of God's providence, if the Lord will, or if the Lord permit. God would not have us too carnally confident. It is good to inure the soul to changes. Now, two things we should often consider to this purpose, and they are both in the text. First, the sovereignty and dominion of providence. The Lord can blast your enterprise, though managed with never so much wisdom and contrivance. He can nip it in the bud or check it in the very article of execution. And I have observed that usually God is very tender of his honor in this point, and usually frustrates proud men that boast of what they will do and conceive unlimited purposes without any thought of the check they may receive in providence or from God. It is a flower of the imperial crown of heaven and the bridle that God has upon the reasonable creature to dispose of the success of human affairs. Therefore, herein God will be acknowledged. Proverbs 16, verse 9, a man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. Man designs, but the execution depends wholly or fully upon God's will and providence. In peremptory resolutions, there is a contest between us and heaven about will and power. Therefore, in such cases, the answer of providence is more express and decisive to the creature's loss, that God may be acknowledged as Lord of success and the first mover in all means and causes, without whom they have no force and efficacy. Secondly, consider the frailty and uncertainty of your own lives. Our being is as uncertain as the events of providence. If we live and God will, are the exceptions of the text, and do imply that there must be a sensible impression of our own frailty, as well as of the sovereignty of providence, that the heart may the better submit to God. It is said in Psalm 146, verse 4, his breath goeth forth, he returneth to his earth, in that very day his thoughts perish. Frail men are full of thoughts and projects. This they will do and that they will do. Go to such a city, promote their interests by such an alliance, gain so much by such a purchase, and then they will raise up some stately fabric which shall continue their name in memory to succeeding generations, and all this because they do not mind the earth which they carry about them, and how soon the hand of providence is able to crumble it into dust. Certainly, man will never be wise till he is able to number his days and does sufficiently possess his soul of the uncertainty of his abode in the world. Psalm 90, verse 12. Now, his observation from the next words, we shall live and do this or that. Mark, it is not enough that God suffer us to live or allow us to live, but he must also, by the same will, suffer us to do or act. The point is that God's will concurs not only to our lives, but our actions. We may live and yet not be able to do anything for the promotion of our designs. For if God suspends his concurrence, the creatures cannot act, at least not with any towardliness and success, which quite crosses the doctrine of the heathen philosophers. Seneca said that we live, it is by the benefit of the gods, that we live well, it is of ourselves. So Tully, this is the judgment of all men, that prosperity is to be sought of God, but wisdom to be gotten by ourselves. Those are the heathen philosophers. But in the scriptures, we are taught otherwise, not only to seek success of God, but direction. He gives abilities to perform and a blessing when the action is finished. Without the efficacious as well as permissive will of God, we can do nothing. He must give us life and all things necessary to action. We must not only look up to him as the author of the success, but the director of the action. It is by his conduct and blessing that all things come to pass. Our very counsels and wills are subject to the divine government, and he can turn them as it pleases him, Proverbs 21, verse 1. And therefore, we must not only commit our ways to his providence, but commend our hearts to the tuition of his Spirit, his Holy Spirit. In short, all things are done by his will and must be ascribed to his praise. That's the end of verse 15. We'll go on to verse 16. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Here the apostle comes to charge more closely their arrogant presumption of outward success upon their consciences, especially it being aggravated by professed acknowledgement and avowing of it against the threatenings of the word. Now again, he goes through the words of the verse. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. It is not easy to define of what boastings the apostle means. The persons to whom he wrote are charged in chapter 2 with glorying in their riches, and afterward for bearing up upon a mere profession of godliness and glorying in their supposed religion. After that, he charges them with glorying in a presumption of wisdom manifested in their censorious insultations over the failings of others in chapter 3. And now, last of all, for their glorying in their carnal hopes or fond prognostications of their success of their own endeavors, as if their lives and actions were in their own power and exempted from the dominion and government of providence. Probably all these may be intended, for the apostle's expression is plural, ye glory in your boastings, though I conceive the latter is principally intended, their avowing their confidence, notwithstanding the many threatenings which were ready to be executed upon them. For though the apostle's doctrine be of general use, and at all times we must conceive our purposes with submission to the will of God, yet his chief drift is to check the security, carelessness, and carnal confidence of their hearts, judgments now approaching, and the happiness of the Jewish affairs running low, even to the bottom and the dregs. For you shall see in the beginning of the next chapter, he presently rings them a loud peal of threatenings, and represents the avenging judge as at the door or at hand to recompense their iniquities. Now, because they would justify their confidence, yea, glory in it, what sad thoughts soever others had of the times, he says, ye rejoice or glory in your boastings. Now, the next words, such rejoicing is evil. That is, though you think it a brave confidence, yet certainly it is but a carnal security. He says no more of it, but it is evil, because they defended it as good. It is evil as coming from an evil cause, pride, and wretched security. It is evil in its own nature as being an outbraving of the word. It is evil in its effects as hindering you from good and putting you upon traffic and aspiring projects when you should more solemnly mind humbling duties and be afflicted and weep and mourn, etc., as is pressed before in verse 9. And this, I conceive, is the mind of the apostle in this verse, which is usually passed over by interpreters slightly, without that necessary regard which should be had to the scope of the context and epistle. Now note, hence, observation 1, that such is the degeneration of human nature that it does not only practice sins, but glory in them. Man fallen is but man inverted and turned upside down, his love where his hatred should be, and his hatred where his love should be, his glory where his shame should be, and his shame where his glory should be. Many count strictness a disgrace and sin a bravery. The apostle said in Philippians 3:19, they glory in their shame. It comes to pass sometimes through ignorance, men mistake evil for good and so call revenge, valor, or resolution, and prosperity in an evil way, the blessing of providence upon their zealous endeavors, and presumptuous carelessness, a well-built confidence. God charged it upon his people that they had made great feasts of rejoicing when they had more cause to mourn. Jeremiah 11:15, the holy flesh is passed from thee when thou dost evil, then thou rejoicest. Usually, by our fond mistakes, thus it is we are blessing and praising God when we have more cause to humble and afflict our souls. Sometimes it is through stupidness and sottishness of conscience, stupid usually meaning like being in a stupor. When men have worn out all honest restraints, then they rejoice in evil and delight in their perversities, Proverbs 2, verse 14. The drunkards think there is a bravery in their strength to pour in wine and can boast of the number of their cups. The soaken adulterer of so many acts of uncleanness, the swearer thinks it the grace of his speech to interlard it with oaths, and proud persons think conceited apparel is their best ornament. Whither is man fallen? See how far man has fallen. First we practice sin, then defend it, then boast of it. Sin is first our burden, then our custom, then our delight, then our excellency. Observation 2, that we have no cause to rejoice or glory in our carnal confidence. It seems to come from a generous bravery, but indeed from lowness and baseness of spirit. It is but a running away from evil, not a mastering of it. Men dare not lay it to heart because they know not how to fortify themselves against it. Faith and true confidence always supposes and prepares for the worst, but hopes the best. It meets the adversary in open field and vanquishes it. The fool in the gospel durst not think of his death that night, Luke 12:16 and 17, etc. This is the baseness of carnal confidence, to put off trouble when it cannot put it away, and however it scorns the threatening, it fears the judgment, and are so ill provided to bear it that they durst not so much as think of it. Right, and that is the end of verse 16, and we'll go on to verse 17 to finish the chapter. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. In this verse, the apostle takes off the prejudice and cavil whereby his admonition might be slighted and evaded. They might reply, we have no need to be taught such a plain lesson. We know that life is short, and that God's providence governs all things. Do you, says the apostle, know all this? Then you are the more obliged to subject your desires to his will and pleasure, which he proves by this general rule. There is nothing difficult in the words, but that to him it is sin, that is sin indeed. There is more of the nature of sin, there is more of the effects of sin, which he shall find in his own conscience and in hell torments and God's judiciary dispensations. Like sayings you have elsewhere, see John 9:41 and John 15:22. But you will say then, are those that sin out of ignorance wholly or fully free from sin? I answer, no, for, number one, sins of ignorance are sins, though more remissible, 1 Timothy 1:13, though not so highly punished, Luke 12:47. God's law was once impressed upon our natures, and we are obliged to all that was written upon Adam's heart. Number two, affected ignorance renders us highly culpable, 2 Peter 3:5, when men shut the windows and resist the light, for then they might know but would not. They willingly don't. Now out of this verse observe, observation number one, that it is not enough to know good, but we must do it also. Gifts in the mind without a change in the heart will not stead you. Often we find that men of much knowledge are apt to be enslaved by their appetites, the lower and more brutish faculties, and though they be orthodox, yet unmortified, keen against errors, but indulgent of vices. Oh, consider, you should add to knowledge temperance, 2 Peter 1:5, otherwise what will it avail you? Others are ignorant of God in their minds, and you deny him in your lives. Others question the truth of religion, and you deny the power of it. Besides, it serves to check slighting thoughts of a plain truth. We are apt to say, I know this enough already. Ah, but do you practice it? Is not this a new hint from God to convince me of my negligence? Surely God sees I do not live up to this knowledge. Therefore, the same truth, this common truth, is returned to my mind, etc. Observation 2. Sins of knowledge are most dangerous. They are more sins than others, as having more of malice and contempt in them. There is more contempt both of the law of God and of God's kindness. See Matthew 11:20. It is a sign you love sin as sin. For when you know what it is, you adventure upon it. Besides, sins against knowledge have more of the marks of God's vengeance upon them. In the reprobate, they are punished with great despair and horror of conscience. See Proverbs 5, 11-14. Or with hardness of heart, iron, often heated and often quenched, grows the harder. It is just with God to punish contempt of light with obduracy, or with madness against the truth. The most moral heathens were the sorest persecutors, as Severus, Antoninus, etc. This is sensibly and clearly discerned in apostates who are carried on with most willful malice against the truths which they once professed. Hosea 5 verse 2, the revolters are profound to make slaughters. Forward professors turn violent persecutors. They would fain quench the light shining in their own bosoms. Alexander, once a disciple, but he made shipwreck of the faith, 1 Timothy 1:20, and he is the man that must set on the multitude against Paul. And he says, see Grotius on Acts 19:33. The Jews drew out Alexander and beckoned with the hand. The same man is intended, for he dwelt at Ephesus, as we learn by both the epistles of Timothy. Now the Jews set him up as the fittest accuser of Paul. He knew his doctrine, and he must appear to turn all the blame of the uproar upon the Christians. Once more, we read of this Alexander as a desperate enemy of the truth, 2 Timothy 4:14. Certainly, the rage and malice of such men is the greater because of the abundance of their light which they have renounced. No vinegar so tart as that which is made of the sweetest wine. Proverbs 28, verse 4. They that forsake the law praise the wicked, that is, do not only commit sin, but approve it in others. Still, they are the most violent and forward men. Sometimes God gives them up to sottishness. See Romans 1, 21-23. It is very notable, and it does exceedingly verify the apostle's observation that the most refined and civil heathens, who are presumed to have most light, were given up to the most beastly errors about the nature of God. He says, see Despain's New Observations on the Creed about the beginning. As the Romans and Grecians worshipped fevers and human passions, every paltry thing for God, whereas the Scythians and more barbarous nations worshipped the thunder, the sun in the sky, things terrible in themselves, which plainly discovers God's just judgment in darkening their foolish heart because they were not thankful in the improvement of light received. But the greatest displeasure of God against sins of knowledge is declared hereafter in the torments of hell, where the proportions of everlasting horrors do rise higher and higher according to the several aggravations of sin, Luke 12:48. Thus God punishes sins of knowledge in the reprobate, but his own children do also perceive the difference between these and other sins. Nothing breaks the bones and scourges the soul with such a sad remorse as sins against light. This broke David's heart. Psalm 51:6, thou hadst put knowledge in my inward parts. He had committed adultery against checks of conscience and the watchful light of the inward parts, of his inward parts, etc. I might speak much more upon this argument, but that I only intend hints here. Concerning the danger of sins of knowledge, you may see more in Mr. Thomas Goodwin's treatise called Aggravations of Sins of Knowledge, whose judicious observations being so full and express, I shall presume to add no more myself. In observation 3, sins of omission are aggravated by knowledge as well as sins of commission. The apostle said, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, etc. Usually, in sins of commission, natural light is most working because there is an actual disturbance by which the free contemplation of the mind is hindered, and because foul acts bring more shame and impress more horror than just bare neglects. Yet, to omit a duty against knowledge may be as bad as to tell a lie against knowledge. The rule is positive, enforcing duty, as well as privative, forbidding sin, and according to the knowledge of it, so is the obligation. Oh, that we might be more conscientious in this matter, and be as tender of omitting prayer against light, and neglecting to meditate and examine conscience against light, as we are of committing adultery against light. All right, and that is the end of verse 17. And this brings us to the end of chapter 4. And Lord willing, we will go on next time to chapter 5. But until then, go in hating sin as sin, because it is sin, because it's an affront to God. And may that be out of love to God in our hearts. And may we be very careful and cautious in our hearts of sinning against knowledge and asking God for help to keep us from sin. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.